Imagine you're a conservationist in the world-famous Galapagos Islands working to eradicate invasive predators. Imagine being so successful you witness the recovery of an iconic native species. This is what happened to Carl Campbell.
So in 2012, I worked on Pinzon Island, removed invasive rats off there, and the Pinzon giant tortoise hadn't bred on its home island for 150 years. Within 6 months, we were seeing hatchling tortoises coming out that weren't getting eaten by rats anymore. And we've successfully removed rats off that island.
Completely.
And now that population is able to sort of sustain itself on its own island.
More from Carl later. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. On This Big Ideas, how do we win the battle against feral pests? In Australia today, there are more than 80 introduced vertebrate pest species damaging our environment and agriculture. Rabbits, rodents, cane toads, foxes, feral pigs, the list goes on. Traditional ways of controlling them, like trapping, shooting, or poisoning with 1080, can be effective in contained environments like small islands, but they have limited success on the vast Australian mainland. On the horizon, though, is innovative new technology called Gene Drive, which employs the CRISPR gene editing tool. It's still to be rolled out, but this technology could be a game changer. There are also new biological controls. So how do you gain community and government support for these new tools? And what are the ethical and welfare issues around invasive pest control, which, let's be blunt, usually means killing animals to protect another group of animals? We're looking at the future of feral pest control. I'm at the Australasian Vertebrate Pest Conference with four guests. Dr. Edie MacDonald, Manager of Social Science at the New Zealand Department of Conservation. Dr. Bitter Jones, Chief Science and Strategy Officer at RSPCA Australia. Dr. Mark Tizard, Senior Research Scientist, Genome Engineering, Health and Biosecurity at CSIRO. And Dr. Carl Campbell, Program Director of Island Conservation, Galapagos Islands. So what's Australia's track record like with transformational methods of pest animal control, like, say, the Khaleesi virus in rabbits? Mark Tizard.
Well, I guess we've had 100 years worth of biological control being applied across Australia. We've got, particularly in the plant space, some great successes. On the animal side, over the years, I'd range across to the thing that I know a little bit about. Although I'm not a pest biologist, I'm really a nuts and bolts molecular biologist bringing in these new tools. But certainly in the rabbit space, we've seen huge success in terms of bringing down the rabbit population with myxoma virus, and then with the Khaleesi virus. And what we notice is that you get great success, but you don't get rid of a pest completely, and if you don't, it's coming back. And so in the rabbit space, I guess we've been fortunate that new tools have presented themselves. And we're going through the introduction of yet another new variant of that tool right now, and the signs are that there's some great success there. And now we're ranging across and having a look how we can extend that into another pest, the carp in the riverways, and basing what we are planning on the successes that we've had in the past in that space. But those new types of tools can be limited in terms of how and where you can apply them. So it's not a panacea, it's not a universal approach for everything. So I guess it's really about tailoring to what your pest is and how it's impacting.
Peter, where does the RSPCA stand on pest animal control? What are the criteria that need to be met for the new transformational pest control technologies to be considered humane?
Well, we take an approach where, just to put it in simple terms, if pest animal control can be justified in terms of the reasons why you're doing the control, so firstly, what are the impacts and is your control actually going to mitigate against those impacts? And then whether it's effective, so will your control actually work, will it achieve the aims? And those things are as important as the actual animal welfare impact of the technique, because if you're not doing something for a good reason that's going to involve harming animals, and in most cases killing animals, then I think society sees that as questionable. But if those boxes are ticked, then it's about what impact does a control technique have on the animals involved and on ensuring that non-target animals aren't affected. So we've got a whole suite of technologies now that are used, some of which cause considerable suffering, and a lot of animals are being killed, you know, all the time through pest animal management. So we're very supportive of new technologies that might help reduce the animal welfare impacts of pest control as it is currently carried out.
Reduce the impact, for example, of 1080 poisoning, which leads to, I understand, frequently slow death of animals.
Yeah, so if you look at animal welfare impacts, you're looking at the actual experience that an animal goes through and how long it takes. So those are the two main things to consider when you're looking at pest animal control. 1080, in our view, does cause suffering in species that are poisoned by it, and it's still the main control technique. So, you know, we have to accept that that's what most people are using in many different circumstances. It's great to look at developing more humane techniques that will achieve the same things. But if we can move into areas where we're not actually working in this cycle of species coming back, numbers coming up, large numbers of animals having to be killed all the time, I mean, that's obviously the ideal situation. Yeah. And I guess what a technology like GeneDrive offers, new technologies may offer, is getting away from that cycle, potentially. Yeah. But there may be other ethical issues around those things that go beyond just animal welfare.
Yeah. Edie, we've become much more concerned in Australia, at least, about animal welfare issues in recent times. Is that also the case in New Zealand, that there's a heightened awareness of the importance of these considerations?
Most definitely. New Zealanders are concerned about animals, and we're seeing, like in New Zealand, the shift towards more humane ways to control the population. But still, the current tool, the majority of the tools in our toolbox, the key one is 1080.
Yeah.
And so it's a toss-up that you have to choose between protecting our native species and using 1080. And the current method will be 1080. And that's why, again, the new tools offer so much more hope.
Carl, you work on the Galapagos Islands. Lucky you. I'm sure many people in the room are thinking that at the moment. These are islands that obviously are famous for their vast number of endemic species, but the islands face serious threat from pest animals as well, especially in the form of rodents. Are you tending to have to control those rodents using some of the traditional pest control tools, like, for example, poisons?
Yeah, so in the Galapagos, you know, the largest single threat to biodiversity on the Galapagos and the native species found there, you know, is invasive species. And so the work that I've been doing for the last 20 years there has been systematically working through a whole series of islands, removing invasive species off them. And we only have a limited toolbox, really, with the methods that are available. So for rodents, invasive rodents, in eradications of them, which is what we do, so the permanent removal across an entire landscape, and that's possible on islands, is, you know, if you're anything on any island larger than a couple of football fields, you're going to be utilizing toxins. And with that, these toxins are not target specific. And so with that, you know, we have to also manage, you know, the non-target impacts. So the potential impacts that come from when the birds or animals that we're actually there trying to protect consume bait that have these toxins in them, or consume something that consumed that bait. And these make these projects extremely challenging and really difficult. And so the potential, you know, for gene drive technology or some of these other potential tools that are up and coming, you know, of potentially being species specific, you know, turns from what we're kind of doing in a sort of chemotherapy approach, you know, into a real sort of laser point kind of surgery that you can minimal impact on the species you're attempting to actually protect in the system.
So how many instances are there of non-target species being affected by the aerial baiting that you are using to try and control pest populations on the Galapagos at the moment?
So typically what we work on with this is we'll have a planning process. And with that, we do non-target risk assessments early in the piece, and with that we're able to then look at which species are potentially at risk, and then we can actually conduct actions to mitigate and minimise those risks. Mm. There are impacts on the species, you know, native species that they're trying to protect. But we take a longer term view on it. And so these are short term impacts, and those populations can recover without those invasive species present. And some of the examples, so in 2012, I worked on Pinzon Island, removed invasive rats off there, and the Pinzon giant tortoise hadn't bred on its home island for 150 years. And within 6 months, you know, we were seeing hatchling tortoises coming out that weren't getting eaten by rats anymore. And, you know, we've successfully removed rats off that island completely.
Wow.
And now that population is able to sort of sustain itself, you know, on its, you know, own island. You know, the only reason tortoises are still there is because they live for more than 150 years.
Yeah. Yeah, wow, that's a real reward that comes from the job when you can see something like that happen as a result of your work. That's fantastic. Edie, I should point out, actually, New Zealand too aspires to be predator-free by 2050 with the aid of some of the transformational pest control technologies. Is this actually achievable, New Zealand being predator-free by 2050?
It's an ambitious goal, and we hope that we achieve it, and we're doing everything we can right now to plan so that we can achieve it. And there's a plan to get there with investment into scientific tools, but also understanding the public's perception and their social license of these new tools that will get us there, because we recognize the current tools that we have will not get us to predator-free 2050.
Okay, Mark, so the big tool that everyone's talking about at this conference and elsewhere is gene drive, the potentially game-changing new hope for controlling and perhaps eradicating some pest animals. This is complex science, I know. Can you briefly outline how gene drive technology works for us?
Yeah, so I guess to pick up on what Carl was saying, the beauty of gene drive is the species specificity, because the technique ultimately involves genes and a genetic manipulation. But what it allows us to do, if we can achieve it, is to place a gene in a pest species, a gene which will duplicate itself. And so the outcome of the duplication is it's site-specific duplication, and what it means is that instead of as with the sort of traits that we're used to thinking about, blue eyes or whether you lose your hair or not, you get a gene from your mum and a gene from your dad, and it's a 50-50 chance which one you'll get. With gene drive, it's able to duplicate itself. So it copies across from the mum gene to the dad gene. So all the offspring inherit the trait that you put in, and all the reproductive events that follow with any animal that carries a gene drive, all of the offspring will carry that trait. The upshot of that is over a few generations, eventually you get to a situation where all of the individuals within a population will carry gene drive because they're all crossing with each other. So the opportunity it presents us is to push a trait into a population. In this case, we're thinking of a pest population, a trait that allows us to control that population. It might be that it's a lethal control, but it might be that it's some other form of control which allows us to add in value in terms of improving the welfare impacts to control that species.
What's an example? I'm imagining here fertility control, obviously. Yep. What are some of the examples that you're thinking of, though?
So the first and simplest example to think of is to use, for example, in the mammal pests that we've got, a gene called SRY. Now, you and I have it, and so does Carl, but Edie and Bitter don't. It's on the Y chromosome, so we're XY, our female panelists are XX.
Yep.
That SRY gene in an embryo tells it to grow up into a phenotypic male. So if we use a gene drive that copies itself and goes into all offspring, those that carry an XX female genetic complement will also get the SRY and will turn into phenotypic males. The upshot of that is, over a series of generations, all of your animals are now male, and you get reproductive collapse of the population. So that's the simplest way of thinking of how you might apply it. Whether that will be the way that we eventually do or not is something that's yet to be explored, but that's an entry point to see if this technology will work. Another way could be, for example, to take an enzyme that's able to convert a neutral molecule, a protoxin, and convert it into a toxic molecule. What you could have then is, if you pick this enzyme, a unique enzyme that's not present in your pest species, not present in all of the species in the environment that you're concerned about poisoning. So you push in a gene drive with this enzyme. You can then put a bait out that carries the neutral chemical that only animals carrying the gene drive will convert into a toxin. and then you protect the native animals in the environment that you don't want to kill with a bait. So that's another way of going, but you know, that's a lethal method, which you know, we may want to look for something else. What I should point out, though, is that, that this technology is in very, very early stages of development. Yes. And what we're doing is we're trying to get out there and explore with other scientists what do they know about the biology of the individual pests that might give us a handle for control over that pest.
Vast potential, though. Everybody is talking about it. Everybody's talking about it at this conference, and I suppose it illustrates just how desperate things are in a country like Australia with pests running rampant, that we're looking for this potential solution to the problem. So a lot of hope is vested in this technology working.
I guess so. I know that there will be pragmatists, particularly in our audience today, and both here in the conference and on the radio, that will be concerned about, you know, where this is going and whether it's going to be effective. And I think what we know is that we have to understand the biology of the pest and the biology of that pest in the environment that it's affecting to look and see whether this technology will actually be that game-changing introduction. So.
The possibilities really are endless. We are talking about, we haven't actually clarified this, but we're talking about the new CRISPR technology, the new gene editing technology that has potentially vast applicability. So what you could potentially do with, you know, chopping up, rearranging the DNA is at this stage potentially limitless, but how it ends up being applied is still very much, as you say, to be determined.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to advance there in this is I mentioned that this research is in very early stage. What we're looking at with this technology is reversing the order in which scientists approach the problems that they're working on and addressing. Traditionally, scientists have been in the back room, working away, designing their thing, stepping out with their shiny new invention, showing it to the world, and the world goes, that's fantastic, or oh my God, what have you done? What we need to do now as scientists is to get out on the front foot and through opportunities like this to talk with the public and say, look, these are the things that we could do. And we're talking to the wider public because they own the environments in which these things will be applied.
Yeah.
And the experts, like the people in the audience here today, that are out there using traditional methods to manage pests and say, you know, is this the thing that you want to use? Is this going to work? What are your concerns? And then build in to the way that we approach that, the research, responses to those concerns and really trying to get to the heart of the opportunity.
Yeah, there are lessons to be learnt, Edie, from other forms of new technology that have been launched on a public that perhaps haven't been ready for that technology, or in fact, in some cases, have been hostile to it. We've seen public resistance to GM food, to some extent to nanotechnology. We've also seen, actually, some public backlash even to climate change science, because the public believe they haven't been kind of fully brought along in the conversation. How important is public support for these new transformational technologies if they are to be successfully applied down the track?
It's critical, and it's really delightful to hear Mark, who's working away in a laboratory, saying that he wants to flip the way we engage with people, the nations, about this technology. So the research that we're doing over in New Zealand that's funded by our National Science Challenge, they fund the laboratory research, but they're also funding the social science component to understand this. So we have a piece of research that we're doing to look at the social license. Does New Zealanders accept different forms of these novel technologies? And we're going to compare and contrast what New Zealanders think of different techniques that are either a new poison, something that's results in sterile offspring, or, as Mark noted, something that perhaps might be genetic and it might lead to a death or sterility. And we're going to compare and contrast what New Zealanders think in between wasps and rats and see if there's a difference. Do New Zealanders, will they let us do anything to wasps because they're a nuisance species, they're a bug, it's okay. But a rat, not so sure. Mm. And what we're really going to look at is not the facts and the science, but the underlying values of New Zealanders.
Yeah.
Because people make their decisions not based on the scientific facts, but on their value system. And no value system is right or wrong. And so if we don't start having those conversations in a value forum, we're going to end up with a climate change debacle again.
Mm. It is, of course, true that facts rarely change people's minds. And we've seen that played out to some extent with the vaccination debate. But it is also a bit depressing, don't you think, that you can't change someone's mind with scientifically verifiable facts?
No, if you're a psychologist, you know this. And there's many things that you probably do that are completely irrational, but predictable. Mm. And it's just human nature. Mm. And I won't go into all the theories behind it, but we need to start having value-based conversations. And again, not imposing our values as a conservationist or a biologist, but understanding the nation's values and different clusters of people will have similar values and having that conversation. It's been highly effective in the US once they learn that about climate change.
What do you think can be learnt actually from the climate change experience that could be applied to the introduction of new technologies? What have been some of the mistakes perhaps that scientists have made along the way?
I would like the biological scientists and the scientists in the lab to be more emotional. I would like them...
Gee, that's a big call.
I know. Again, when they have the conversations, when they're interviewed, when they're in the public arena, they talk about the facts, they talk about the scientists, the evidence, the p-values, the correlations, and the public don't listen to that. I want them to get emotional. I want them to talk about the values and the emotions, because those are the conversations you have in the grocery store with your neighbors, not the stats behind the technology. It's that conversation of shared values, which is where people make their decisions.
Carl, are you feeling like you've can emotionally invest in this and should be emotionally investing in this? Or are you still a kind of cold-hearted clinical scientist at heart?
I'll try and keep off my monotone, but it is, you know, dead on. And it's one of the aspects that, you know, when you're engaging with people, I mean, people don't overly get excited about, you know, until basically you have an emotional argument and can tweak on those aspects, if you will, of where people are rooted. Mm. And so if you want to save species in the Galapagos Islands and still be able to go there and visit it and see, you know, the things that you see in all of the, you know, wildlife documentaries, well, then you've got to make some tough calls and you've got to say, well, yes, we're going to do these things. And there currently are some pretty significant costs, you know, to doing that. But those are sort of aspects that, you know, you need to basically say, yes, I'm, you know, we're willing to do that.
And our relationship to animals is essentially a largely an emotional one as well. So if we are to visit the Galapagos Island and to see one of these magnificent turtles in its natural habitat, that evokes a terribly powerful emotional response from us. So it's perhaps not surprising that emotion should play a role in this.
It does, but most people aren't connected to that. Most people are sitting at home in their apartment somewhere, you know, maybe they do get to see it, you know, when they turn on Nat Geo or something, you know, on TV. But the other issue that we face now is that connectivity with animals works against us. So we have this same side conflict because we're having to remove animals to save animals. Yeah. And that's a really challenging message, yeah, you know, to try and indicate to someone. And so these new tools that we're looking at, you know, potentially get us away from that because it becomes less about killing animals. Mm. And we all love animals, like everyone in this room and within this panel, yeah, we all love animals. We're not killing animals because we like doing that. And so if we had other tools to use, we would be using them, but we don't at present. And so we're locked into this sort of, you know, I'm tied to saving species. And so we will continue utilizing the current tools that we have until these other tools are essentially available.
Carl Campbell, Program Director of Island Conservation on the Galapagos Islands.
On RN, you're listening to Big Ideas with Paul Barclay.
We're talking about the future of pest animal control. Our other speakers are Edie MacDonald, Mark Tizard, and up next from the RSPCA, Bitter Jones.
It's fascinating hearing people talking about being more emotional, because probably that is the one criticism that you get working in the animal welfare movement, is don't get all emotional about animals. We've got to be more clinical and scientific about it. So, yeah, I'm really interested in this different view. But I think We do tend to use emotion to help influence people's behaviour, and it's currently happening all the time in pest animal control because we demonise pest animals, and that is a manipulation of our emotional response to them, to actually put them in a category that they are the evil ones, they are the ones that are destroying the landscape, whereas of course they're not doing that deliberately, they're just doing what they do, and we have the responsibility to deal with that problem, but I think we have a responsibility to deal with it ethically. I think even though we know that actually helping to influence behaviour is best done in terms of targeting emotions and values, we've got to still make sure that the choices and decisions we're making are informed ones. So whilst you can go to the public and ask them what they think, you also have to make sure that in the discussion you've got a diverse range of stakeholders who are able to represent different informed views. So, for example, in terms of the idea about gene drive and having the early conversation, which I think is crucial, that conversation needs to be had in terms of what the social acceptability is, but also looking at those different groups that, I talk about this from an animal welfare perspective, I'd be looking at this in terms of what it means for animal welfare, but also what it means from an ethical perspective in terms of should we be doing this, how, because these are big questions that we're asking here.
Yeah.
You know, manipulating species is a very big deal.
It's profound, so, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and particularly when you're doing something, potentially once you've made the decision that it's out there, you can't get it back. Mm. You've opened the box and it's gone. And unfortunately, you know, scientists aren't perfect. We have made mistakes, and the cane toad is probably the most famous example of that. Mm. So, you know, we put something out there thinking it would do good, and it's done us an awful lot of harm. Mm. So, you know, you can't be surprised if the public is skeptical about this sort of thing. We really do need to make sure we are considering everything, and that involves diversity of consultation before we make that decision.
This is a new approach, though, relatively speaking, for scientists, Mark, the idea that you have a conversation with the public about a new technology before that new technology is even developed is a fundamental flipping of how science has traditionally worked.
Absolutely right. I think, you know, picking up on some threads of conversation there, it is a reversal, and it's because, I guess, as a group of scientists working in this space, recognising the opportunity, we've also recognised the potential for legitimate concern. And so there's an international community of scientists that are involved in this outreach. There have been a number of international meetings, a number of high-profile scientific publications that are out in this space, reports that have come out from the National Academy of Science in the US, just yesterday the report coming out from the Australian Academy of Sciences, addressing the issues of both the potential and the concerns. And it's become very clear, and to link into what Edie was saying, it's become very clear for us as lab scientists that we can't just go away and make something and then wheel it out. We have got to, because of the time and the effort it's going to take, because of the risks that might be involved and how we need to mitigate them, we have to be on the front foot to ensure that we maintain public confidence in the safety of what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve, and that we get public input and consultation as to why we're doing it, where it's going to. An interesting word that I picked up from Edie and her colleagues is publics. Not just public. Yeah. And when I type that into my documents, it comes up with a spell check. Right? Mm. But publics, there are different public audiences that this needs to be taken out to, and different interests, vested interests in the potential outcomes. So, for example, the cane toad. You know, now we might not be going down gene drive, but there is a gene technology opportunity to mitigate the impact of cane toads. Well, you know, sitting in Melbourne, I don't see one. But in the Northern Territories, the Aboriginal people on the land, it's wrecking the land. They recognise it. They're in tears over what it's doing. It's impacting on their culture. They want something done about it. Here's an opportunity. That's the public that we most need to address in that space. But for each of the different types of pests we're dealing with, there are different constituents. And people working in agriculture will be, you know, on the front foot about mice and about rabbits. People who are worried about ecology will be on the front foot about cats and wild dogs and foxes. So you have to look at your different publics and opportunities.
I get the idea that with such a radical new science as gene drive, that we want to proceed slowly and cautiously and we want to engage with the public, Edie, but consensus is not possible on this. There is always going to be a vast range of different opinions. How do you know when the public is ready to accept a new transformational piece of technology?
There's no magic number. There's no survey or public opinion poll that once we reach a certain percentage, da-da, we can roll it out. It's not that simple. It's a new area for us. So I'll let you know when we figure it out.
Interestingly, there's been a conversation in the press just this week around this technology, actually, Mark, the CRISPR technology and its possible application to mosquitoes as a way of controlling dengue. And a part of that conversation, and malaria as well, and a part of that conversation repeats this oft-stated concern that if a technology is used to make an existing species like a mosquito infertile, and they then get bred out of the environment, what might the consequences be on the entire ecosystem? And I would imagine that that's something that people are thinking out more generally about this technology. How would you respond to that?
The example of the mosquito is a really good one. So the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust have an initiative called Target Malaria, and they're exploring gene drive, and if it is eventually deployed, if the public comes along on the journey and ticks whatever boxes need to be ticked and it's eventually deployed, that will probably be the very first instance that we see of gene drive being out there in the real world. Now, you know, the very first thoughts in that space were, hey, you could turn all the mosquitoes male, because the male mosquito doesn't bite, so it can't transmit diseases like malaria and dengue and so forth.
Bingo, problem solved.
Fantastic, and then you get collapse of the population, no more mosquitoes, no more malaria, but then you've got a gap in an ecosystem, and anyone that understands these things knows that gaps don't last. They'll be filled by something else, and the concern is that it'll be filled by something worse. The other thing is that there's the unexpected consequence. If you take out those mosquitoes, now at the end of that process, you've got no male mosquitoes, and it's known that they are involved in pollination of particular plant species. What's the repercussion of that? It's known that mosquito larvae are food for various fish and other invertebrates in water systems. What's the consequence of that? So, you know, early discussions in this space are, this might not be a good idea. So the approach that they're taking is to say, let's not wipe out the mosquito, but let's find out what allows the parasite, the malaria parasite, to be carried by the mosquito. Can you do something to change that? Can you block the ability for the mosquito to pass the disease around? Now all you're excluding from the system is a disease-causing agent. Is that going to have an unexpected consequence? Maybe, but maybe not. But that one has less obvious. Now, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean there won't be one, but that it has no obvious consequences like trying to eradicate a mosquito. So I think that's, again, something we have to consider about the use of the technology being tailored to the specific need of the issue that you're trying to address.
So just thinking about this technology and its possible application, what, from your vantage point right now, what would you say the risks and downsides are, and what are the kind of regulatory and ethical issues and hurdles that you'd need to clear before you could proceed any further?
Well, top of the list is the social license to operate. I think, you know, in this space, engaging with the public and ensuring that we have a majority of people in favour of proceeding with the technology is most important, because what the people think is going to influence the politicians. The politicians are the ones that set the policy, which is enacted in regulation, and we've got to get this through regulatory processes. Now, we know how those regulatory processes stand now, and in simplistic terms, if we are making a change to a pest organism, and if what we do doesn't make that pest more pesty, and in fact, if it encumbers the pest and disables it in some way, then the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the regulators, that we have conversations with them regularly, and they say, well, you know, you'll need to show it to us. We've got to look at the nuts and bolts, but in essence, we don't have an objection to this. So we can see a pathway forward in that respect. But, you know, if anything gets through this process that the public accepts, that the politicians are on side with, the regulation allows us to enact, it still has to go through a process. There will be a screening and a vetting process. I think from the public's point of view, they should remain confident that nothing's going to be done that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
On top of that, we've got the issue of, you know, the scientific community
yep.
within which this is being conducted that are also looking at it. So right now there's a document being circulated globally, Principles for the Funders of Gene Drive Research. And all the countries around the world that are currently showing activity in this space are signing on to it, including Australia. Mm. And that's helping to guide us in terms of ensuring that the scientific community also looks at this and says, you know, we're looking at this from every angle and we're ensuring that there's no immediate and obvious pitfall.
Long way to go, Carl, but could you envisage this being a game changer on the Galapagos Islands in terms of a potential genetic control agent for the rodents that are causing so much chaos on the islands?
Down the track, definitely. So island conservation, we're involved in a partnership that includes Australia, New Zealand and US organisations, all of which are non-profit or government. And that's the Genetic Biocontrol and Invasive Rodents Program. And that partnership is sort of looking at a suite of different aspects, trying to sort of move this forward in both regulatory terms, in the social aspects, or all the different areas that it is. Somewhere like the Galapagos is not somewhere we would be looking to roll this out initially, because the regulatory environment for Ecuador is not basically at the level, for example, that you would see in the US, Australia, and New Zealand. Mm. So down the track, countries like Ecuador, I mean, yes, but we're at least taking the viewpoint and looking to basically try and work with the toughest regulatory environments on the planet that have the appropriate capacity to be able to evaluate these tools and actually have them talking with each other, so that we're sort of looking to cover all of those and then even treating that as a minimum level. To answer your question, yes, I think, and this, you know, is a highly transformative tool
yeah.
that has a lot of potential. Work that we're doing now is looking to try and find as early as possible deal breakers. Mm. You know, so like any innovation aspect that you work on, you don't want to invest 20 years worth if you should have chopped this off at year number two.
Mm.
So looking for those deal breakers early, what are they, whether they be social aspects or other concerns, technical concerns even, you know, those are the kind of things that we're trying to uncover as early as possible.
Yeah, I'm getting a real sense here that no one wants to overly raise expectations at this early stage. However, I'll raise expectations a little bit in this question. Peter, does this have the potential to address some of the animal welfare issues that pertain to old school pest control technologies? I mean, if you had a genetic form of fertility control that could, you know, potentially wipe out an invasive species without having to shoot them or bait them, that could be a major advance in terms of humane pest control, right?
Yeah, it could. So let's assume that all the other boxes are ticked and that there are no unforeseen effects. If you look at it from a theoretical point of view, we've talked about fertility control being the closest thing to a silver bullet
yep.
that we might have. Fertility control, even through gene drive, there's a number of caveats there. You've got to have a species that reproduces fairly rapidly in order for the effects to actually spread through the population at a speed that's going to be effective in terms of dealing with impacts of a pest animal. And you also have to ensure that you're able to use other tools. So it's not going to get rid of, you know, even if this worked as well as it could do, it's not going to get rid of those.
Yeah.
You know, you've actually still, unfortunately, will be still killing animals for a long time to come. And there are limits to the effect, to the applications of
yep.
this technique. So I guess what would concern me is if we've invested all of our efforts and resources into this particular technology at the expense of actually still looking for more humane ways of dealing with the pest species that this isn't going to help, and in terms of improving the humaneness of the techniques that are still going to be used.
Yeah, in other words, you'd like to see, for example, an alternative to 1080 developed?
And maybe that's a good example to talk about raising expectations, because for a long time we've in Australia we've been talking about the development of PAP as an alternative to 1080.
It's a PAP more being
It's a more humane toxin that has, well, basically similar effects. It's put into baits in the same way that 1080 is. And the initial conversations about PAP were very, very positive in terms of, oh, this is going to be a more humane replacement. It will be a replacement. There'll be an antidote so that people who have concerns about domestic dogs being poisoned, for example, that those things will be solved. Now, that isn't actually what's happened, because often, probably more often than not, these things are much more complicated and more difficult than they're often portrayed in the first instance. So I think it is really important, whilst you have to be optimistic about what things can do, don't make them out to be too good, because you will be disappointed in the end. And whilst, you know, I wouldn't work in animal welfare if I wasn't an optimist, but I think we need to have those caveats.
Bitter Jones from the RSPCA.
You're with Paul Barclay on RN, and this is Big Ideas, the home of the finest talks from Australia and around the world.
This discussion on the future of pest animal control was recorded in Canberra at the Australasian Vertebrate Pest Conference.
I think, Mark, the point that Bitter makes there, that gene drive technology doesn't render other methods redundant, like, for example, biological control. And in fact, we're seeing and have seen some new tools in the biological control front, one of them being the biological control, the virus for introduced carp. 90% of the fish biomass in parts of the Murray-Darling Basin is now made up of carp. The female carp produces up to 1 million eggs per year, and the fish can tolerate almost any habitat at all. So that's giving an idea of the problem that we face. So there is a biological agent, the carp herpes virus, that can apparently kill carp without affecting other species. Where are we up to with that? My understanding is that that's all been developed, done, and is pretty much ready for release.
Yeah, there's a process going ahead to work out how this will be deployed, where, when, and what the impacts will be. Obviously, you know, the best outcome is it's going to kill carp in large numbers. That's going to create a waste biomass that's got to be removed from waterways. So,
a waste biomass, you mean lots of dead fish floating on the surface and being washed up on the shore, potentially.
Potentially, yeah. And so what's being undertaken at the moment is developing a plan to get out into communities to spread the message about how this is going to be rolled out, to get people into, when that happens, to assist in and how it will be controlled. But within that is a whole range of studies that have been performed up front leading up to this point. People within our organisation who are experts in this field that have assessed that this is not going to have any impact on other fish species that's going to be specific to the carp. And then looking at how this thing is going to actually travel through the waterways. That helps you then to map where it's going to go and how you can deploy it and when you can deploy it.
Yeah.
So that's actually interesting, because if it works in the way that it's expected to work, it should have an effect similar to the viruses that have been deployed to control rabbits. So you'll get hopefully a dramatic crash in the population of carp. And that is something that, in terms of discussion going on, has opened the conversation about the potential for gene drive as a method to come in and, if you like, mop up the residual population that isn't either reached by the virus or that may develop some resistance to the virus. And so it's opening a doorway for us, because we know there'll be hopefully a relatively long lead time before those carp populations start to build up and recover.
That's how you potentially see gene drive technology working in conjunction with other forms of biocontrol.
Absolutely. I mean, like, it's one of these things that, again, in terms of moderating expectations, is to say that this isn't necessarily something that comes on and replaces all the things that people have done before. There are very specific opportunities to introduce it, and where it's used hand in hand with the conventional methods. I think that's where the power will be. It's giving it a different tool that can work in complement to the current tools.
So, Edie, how might the public respond to the sight of rivers full of dead carp, knowing that, in a sense, it's a good thing, because most of us know the problem that the carp is causing? On the other hand, can you imagine the photographs in our newspapers of dead carp floating on the top of the water and, you know, washed onto the shore of riverbanks and so on?
Yeah, and that goes back to probably what Bid is quite familiar with, is people don't like the sight of animals dying. Even if we know that they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, an animal is still dying. And so what you need to do is prepare the public for that, which is what Mark has talked about. You know, so just because they might be ready to roll it out, they're in the process of working out the steps that are necessary, both logistically and from a public perception, to alleviate some of that angst that might come from if the rivers were hypothetically filled with dead carp. So, and it's also about just having that conversation that that could be the worst case scenario, but in the long term, the gains are going to be much better. So short term, there might be some stinky dead fish, but in the long term, it's going to bring back the health of the river system.
There is also a new strain of Khaleesi virus for rabbits that I hear is also potentially quite effective in dealing with rabbit control. Now, the problem you have there in terms of public opinion is, once again, you have a situation where the public recognises largely the rabbit problem in Australia. But there are people who have pet rabbits who don't want their pet rabbits to be killed by a new virus that's being introduced. How do you go about managing that inherent conflict?
From my understanding, in Australia, there's mechanisms to deal with that.
Yeah, there is a vaccine, I think, to prevent pet rabbits catching the new Khaleesi virus. But still, the rabbit owners aren't 100% reassured by this.
Well, we've got this complication that we've got an existing strain of Khaleesi virus that has been out there for some time. We've got the RHDV-K5 boost project, which is a new Korean strain of the virus, so just call it K5. And then we've got another strain, RHDV2, that has appeared in Australia. Nobody quite knows how, where it came from, but it's been spreading and it's now been reported in I think almost every state. So we've got three different things, and rabbit owners are confused about that. I mean, as soon as you start talking about different strains of viruses, a lot of people have just already lost
eyes glaze
interest.
Over. Yeah.
And the existing vaccine only protects against two of those. And rabbit owners aren't, and they don't know what they've got. So I think it's been a very complicated picture, and not one that hasn't been deliberately as complicated, but the fact that this other strain has appeared in the mix has made it harder for those people involved in the rollout of K5, which is now out there, to actually communicate their message. I think they've probably done a pretty good job, actually, given that complication.
Yeah.
But what we've learned in this story is that there's an awful lot of people who haven't actually been vaccinating their pet rabbits in the first place. From my point of view, if that message is now out there...
From Queensland, and Queensland's dealt with this rather simply, and that is by just banning them as pets altogether.
Yeah, and also when it comes to public acceptance, remember, we're never going to get 100% acceptance of anything. Yeah. In what instance has 100% of all Australians agreed on anything? Drunk driving limits, alcohol consumption, helmets for bicycles. Probably the only thing that brings Australians together is their dislike of New Zealanders and the All Blacks, you know? And so we have to understand that we've pushed through regulations and new initiatives that didn't have 100% public perception, but it's for the greater good.
Yeah.
And so that's what you have to aim at, that greater good. We can only push those things through if the public trust those of us that are creating these products, these initiatives, programs, and there's a lot of safeguards. So no one has to worry about things happening in the next few years. It's going to be a long time before we see these new technologies rolled out.
You have the kind of challenging issue whereby rabbits are both a terribly big pest, but are also pets. And you have the same situation, in fact, with dogs and cats as well, that they are a huge pest, but also we love our cats and dogs. Does that cloud the discussion somewhat? Like, for example, I understand in New Zealand you have said that you'll be predator-free by 2050, but this does not include the cat.
No, so the government initiative was quite strategic, and in the decision they've targeted only a handful of pests, so rats, possums, and stoats. So cats, pigs, deer, numerous other introduced species are not in the predator-free 2050 mandate. And in one sense, it alleviates a lot of the angst that the public could have. So I think we can focus our energy on those three species. We'll get a lot of conservation gains. And then in between now and 2050, we can tackle the other issues. But let's focus on those key species first and get that right, and then have the public dialogue about cats and dogs. We're having those conversations now, but we probably won't use novel technologies to control cats. That's going to be more of a public buy-in.
Bring the cats inside at night.
Yep.
Mark, there's an elephant in the room with, particularly with this new technology, and that is that it is an inescapably GM. And I think, you know, it's really interesting. It was eye-opening to me when the conversation started, and our colleagues from New Zealand, with their bold goal of predator-free New Zealand by 2050, have entered into this conversation because, you know, generally we accept that New Zealand is not pro-GM, and yet this technology is. So they're starting to consider it. But in terms of how, as scientists, we go out and reverse our order and consult with the public and talk through this, it is clearly going to be GM. And when we're looking at the hopes, the aspirations we have for this in terms of improvement of environmental impacts through pests, we're talking to people who have an interest in the environment, who generally also may not have a very positive predisposition towards GM. And what we're proposing is to release GM out into the environment. And so that's a really important point for, you know, scientists like me to be led by scientists like Edie through this social science aspect of communication with the public, because what we've got is an opportunity. What we need to do potentially is to introduce GM into an environment to improve that environment. And as I've sat back and thought about it, one of the things that a colleague of mine who works with rabbits showed me a lot of images of landscapes that have been impacted by rabbits. And what we forget with a pest organism, because we do this thing of looking at the detail, we see a little fluffy bunny. But what we're looking at is 25,000 rabbit genes in a suite of genes that makes up the ecosystem. That 25,000 gene packet in one rabbit, in millions of copies across that landscape, are dramatically altering that landscape. They're taking out plant species, they're encroaching on the habitat for other animals, and they are genetically modifying that environment. So what we're asking is the permission of the public to introduce something small into a pest that's a GM, that's locked into that pest and can't get out, that nobody has to eat, but that maybe provides us with a solution.
I haven't asked you this question, Mark, but I suppose I should. What is the time frame that we're looking at for gene drive? Is this a 10-year type of horizon before you'd possibly even contemplate releasing it into the environment?
I would say that that's a reasonable estimate in the case of vertebrate pests. It may be slightly shorter in the case of the mosquito and malaria. There's certainly a push to move that forward as fast as possible. And those experiments in the laboratory have already been done. We are just at the very beginning in terms of dealing with vertebrate pests in developing the technology. It hasn't been shown to work yet in vertebrates. There's no reason to believe that it wouldn't work in animals, the fluffy animals that we consider. But yes, I mean, the process of social engagement that needs to go alongside the kind of developments we need to test in the lab will take that kind of time frame for sure.
Dr. Mark Tizard from the CSIRO. Our other guests were Dr. Edie MacDonald from the New Zealand Department of Conservation, Dr. Bitter Jones of RSPCA Australia, and Dr. Carl Campbell of Island Conservation on the Galapagos Islands. That discussion on the future of pest animal control was recorded at the Australasian Vertebrate Pests Conference. Thanks to the Invasive Animals CRC, especially Dr. Ian MacDonald, for their assistance. Check out the Big Ideas website for more information. That's it for this Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now. If you've enjoyed this Big Ideas, you'll find more great discussions from Australia and around the world at abc.net.au/rn/bigideas.